I'm Michael Goldman. Welcome to another installment of Studio Daily's Podcasts from the Frontline series, where each month we talk with filmmakers from various disciplines about their work on current major feature films and broadcast projects. And this month, our guest is executive producer-director Douglas McKinnon, discussing his work on the new Amazon miniseries Good Omens. The show is based on a famous book published in the early 1990s by authors Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman. Gaiman wrote all six episodes of the miniseries, while McKinnon directed all of them. The offbeat comedic show offers a sweeping cinematic story about a desperate race by a pair of highly unlikely partners, an angel, played by Michael Sheen, and a demon, played by David Tennant, to prevent Armageddon after a series of strange events lead to the misplacement of the Antichrist in a small village in the UK. The project posed lots of creative and technical issues, has unique stylized animation and visual effects as part of the mix, and put a series of interesting challenges square on McKinnon's plate. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Doug, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Nice to be here.
And I thought to start at the beginning, the show is, to kind of sum it up very quickly for those who haven't seen it yet, and I hope that they do see it, it's basically a six-episode or six-hour kind of, buddy comedy or movie that's about the unlikely pairing of an angel and a demon who decide that they want to stop, for their own reasons, the looming arrival of Armageddon and the destruction of everything after somebody accidentally misplaces the Antichrist.
I sum it up by saying I think it's a comedy where everybody might die.
Right, which is always hysterical. And there's a lot more to it than that, but that is the basic concept, and that was the concept of the book too, right?
Yeah, it's a pretty faithful adaptation of the book, but additionally Neil wrote some other stuff because it didn't translate completely into script and screen, so he's added, for instance, a half hour extra bit at the beginning of episode 3 that's not in the book that explores Aziraphale, played by Michael Sheen, and Crowley, played by David Tennant's relationship through the last 6,000 years since the beginning of time, since the Garden of Eden, which is where we start.
Which I thought was fascinating. I actually had a question about that in a minute, but and Aziraphale, for those who don't know, is the angel, and Crowley is the demon. Although they're really just pals and occasional drinking buddies. As I understand it, the book had been around since the early 1990s, and there'd been other discussions about how could it be adapted for TV or film and that sort of thing. Could you maybe briefly explain what the problem always was with that, why it was a difficult piece of material to adapt, why it took so long, and then what went right this time that made you guys figure it out and get it on the screen?
Well, I've only been attached to the project for 2.5 years, but I'll give you the history as far as I know it, which is that after Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman wrote the book, and I think it was the very late 80s when they finished it, and the early 90s when it was published around the world, immediately people thought it could make a great film. And various people tried. Terry Gilliam was attached for nearly 20 years to it and couldn't get it off the ground. And I can tell you a little bit more about Terry Gilliam coming to the premiere last week, if that's of interest.
Oh, it's totally of interest. It takes him about 30 years to make a movie, typically, anyway.
Well, indeed. And he told Neil and I, it was the first time I'd met him, and I was slightly pensive, as you might understand. Such a great director coming along to a screening is a bit of a worry. But he was actually afterwards saying it was a relief to him to see it on the screen. And this goes back to the nub of your question, which he had tried to make it into a two-hour movie, and he had all sorts of people lined up to do it, Robin Williams and Johnny Depp, people like that, and could never get it quite off the ground. And he at the premiere, he sort of said it was because we were trying to abridge it, and it's not a book that can be abridged. It can't be shortened. So the six-hour version that we've made actually gets in all the story that's there and all the complicated little avenues that Neil and Terry wrote all the years ago. And so there was a survey done by the BBC a few years ago about the 100 most loved books in the English language, and Good Omens was in it, but it was the only one, Neil noted, that hadn't been made into a television or film of the 100. So, and why could we do it now? It's because the scale that Amazon Money can give us and the technology has caught up with CGI, that somebody who's doing, you know, top-end television can actually tackle a story and a subject like this. I mean, I said to Neil, he started writing it 4 years ago, the script. I mean, and he said he co-wrote it, but he was the only writer on the script. He co-wrote the book with Terry Pratchett. When he started writing the scripts 4 years ago, we couldn't have made it because the technology wasn't up to speed. So that's what's happened in the last few years, that somebody like me can come along and have, albeit at the top end of a television budget, even these days, but we can actually tell the story and have the CGI and so on to do it.
What was your connection to Neil or the project? How did you get on board, and why did you want to? What about it attracted you to it and all that stuff?
Well, and any story that starts with a sin description exterior Garden of Eden day is going to catch your attention, that's for sure. So I knew Neil's work, and we'd both done Doctor Who's, but we'd never met each other. So it was really the script arriving on my son's 18th birthday was the first I knew that I might get involved, and I immediately told the producer who was calling me that I couldn't possibly read them that day because it's my son's 18th birthday. And she said, "Well, just I'm here in London with Neil. Can you just read the first 10 pages, see if it's something that interests you?" You know, and I said, "Well, okay then." So I cleared everybody out of the kitchen and sat down. And an hour later, I'd read the first script, and I was emailing and phoning her to say, "Stand back. This is my. I have to do this because it's just built for me." And the things that appealed to me about it was were it kind of. The challenge of Good Omens was the challenge it was almost as if I'd been in training for it for the last 10 years with the work I've been doing. So I'd done lots of Doctor Who. I did a Sherlock that won an Emmy that had lots of CGI in it. I'd also done some very heavy drama in the UK, Line of Duty, and it was kind of a mix of that stuff. But Neil's contention is that a show I made the first time I worked with Stephen Moffat. Called Jekyll, which was an update of Jekyll and Hyde, that he'd seen my directing at that point, and the reason I fitted, and I sort of agree with that, is I agree with him in this, that the reason I fitted was because I think if I'm good at anything, I can manage the sharp handbrake turns between darkness and laughter, you know, and not everybody can do that, but I just enjoy it, and I don't try and smooth it down, I try and heighten it, in fact, if anything.
And am I correct? You directed all six episodes of the miniseries, and you're also executive producer. You know, how unusual is it for one guy to say to do six straight episodes on, you know, when you have a TV workload and deadlines and budgets and logistics and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's very rare that that anybody lets you do that because of budgets and so on. But Neil was kind of adamant that he wanted one director's vision as well as his own vision because he also showran the series. So we basically teamed up and did it together. And we, you know, who knows? Time will tell whether we're right or wrong. But we felt that we really had to travel through the whole journey together, and that was the only way we were going to get Neil's vision out from the scripts and Terry's vision out from the book as well. So for better or worse, we embarked on this mad escapade that took 2 years to do. And I'd say it was a bit longer than if you were doing six parts with three directors, which would be the normal thing. But I'm not sure you'd have had Good Omens the way it is, and you know how you know fabulously well it's been received.
And if you're directing, you know, I don't know the pace or the schedule or the workflow, but does that mean you have very limited opportunity to be involved in the post aspects, the finishing, the color grading, the editing, you know, all that
Oh,
stuff?
no.
Or were you in on that too?
No, 100%. In the UK, we have a different system for directors than in the US. The traditional US system is that directors leave the day after the shoot finishes and the executive producers carry it through. In the UK, directors just normally stay till the end of post-production. And in this case, Neil and I travelled on sofas around London for pretty much 10 months, doing all the post-production together. And Neil was there 70, 75% of the time. But no, every frame, every bit of sound, every ADR session I attended, every sound effect was supervised by me and or Neil together. I think what's lovely the way that people are reacting is that they're kind of calling it a handmade looking show, and I think that's what you get because it's the attention to detail, the nuance that makes things work on a higher level.
And before we get too far into some of the crazy stuff with the show itself, I was more than a bit impressed by the opening credits, the animated sequence, and also some of the animated graphics, like in the first episode and elsewhere, that kind of are used to explain stuff that have been going on in the universe between Earth, heaven, and hell since, well, I guess the beginning of creation. So let's give a bit of credit to those folks. You know, who conceived and created those animations, what facility was involved, how did that come about?
So the key person here is a guy called Peter Anderson. It's at Peter Anderson Studios. I've worked with Peter before on Sherlock and on Doctor Who as well. He was the guy that in Sherlock, if you know the show, came up with the graphics that where people are texting and the text appears on the screen in front of them rather than cutting to the text on the phone. He came up with a different way of doing it. So Peter's the main guy. The source of the idea came from a William Kentridge installation in South Africa where we were filming. I just went along on a day off to get some time off. But you on a show like this, you don't really take time off. It's usually research of some kind. And I came across this installation of a marching band and showed it to Peter when we came back, and he lifted it off from there into this sort of amazing cacophony of imagery. That, you know, it clearly there's a kind of a if there's a family tree to the whole of Goodome, it's not just the front titles. Terry Gilliam's animation is sort of, you know, somewhere in the background, as is, you know, the Beatles animations, you know, Help and so on. It's that sort of kind of feel of, because what we were trying to do all the way through, and the music as well, is a kind of with from the amazing David Arnold. What we were trying to do was give a feeling, a tone that was both felt like it was in the zeitgeist, but it was also sentimental at the same time, kind of nostalgic, and yet felt like now and very cool. So it's for others to judge whether we've achieved that, but that was our target.
And you know, as we get into the show, I mean, it's clearly it's six episodes. It's not you know, a linear story. Here's what happened first. Here's what happened second. Here's the climax. You know, so what are the challenges of making it linear in our brains, the viewer, consistent story that we can comprehend and yet jump through history, through time, you know, to kind of show us the backstory of these two eternal characters: Christ's crucifixion, the Garden of Eden, ancient England, World War II. You know, and how you pace all that and put it all together, you know, in post so that it comes out the right way.
Well, the first thing is, quite reasonably, you're calling it series because that's what Amazon call it. But for Neil and I, we've always thought of it as a 6-hour movie. And we hope that people will watch it in that way. And I'd say the core sort of the core idea of holding on to the book was to hold on to the book. And so I remember saying to Neil very early on, and he'd done this anyway, that he'd lifted the book up and said it looks like about 6 hours when he first started writing it. And that's why we've got 6 hours. And I remember saying to him, there's a reason this book has sold 5 million copies around the world. There's a reason that it's loved all around the world by the fans of Neil and Terry Pratchett. It's because it works as a story. So you sort of muck about with that at your peril. So, and we did try and muck about with it a bit, and it didn't work sometimes, and sometimes it did. And but we're trying to find a way through. And what you're doing when you're putting a series like this together is you're building a world that feels secure for the viewer to watch, and where they enjoy surprises rather than be put off by them. You know, and part of the graphics is that tone at the front. You've got immediately got a voice played by of God played by Frances McDormand. You've got Adam and Eve are a, you know, they're not white, they're black, and all the time you're getting familiar with unfamiliar at the same time. And there was a story I used to tell all my heads of department that George Martin told about the Beatles, and when he was asked, why do the great songs work? And he said, well, they usually start off somewhere familiar, and then you're led to a place that you would never have started from. So we start in the most familiar storytelling place, you know, in history, which is the Garden of Eden. And then we lead on from there, and we put these two unexpected characters, a demon and an angel, and we just lead them on from there. And you know, in a way, David Tennant and Michael Sheen's characters are part of the glue that holds you together as you travel, because you keep on coming back to them and keep on coming back to the overall story, which is them trying to save the world through speech, not fight, and a So as long as we keep on coming back to them, then all the little avenues and byways that we take work for most people. For some people, it doesn't work, but for us, it really works because we like the idea of it not being 100 miles an hour, Guardians of the Galaxy all the time. We like a world where you can stop for a cup of tea and a chat on a park bench because that's the feel of the book. So I'd say the core thing for me is to remain that faith in the storytelling in the book and hold on to that love that all the readers had, but also hoping that other people will become entranced with it in the same way. So we get a new, obviously a brand new audience coming along as well.
Well, and I like this notion of not being so bound to rules that you can't do something that you think will help you tell the story or entertain the audience. The third episode, for instance, I think you alluded to it earlier. The format is sort of a little bit of a tease. Then we go to the credits, then we tell the story. Many shows do that. But I think in the third episode, the tease is basically the whole history of their relationship through time at all these great events in history. And it precedes the opening credits, but it's about half the show. It's like a half hour, and I'd never really seen that done before. That was rather unusual. What was the reason you did it that way, and why do you think it would work so well?
Well, it's funny, the very first Sherlock Holmes book, written by Arthur Conan Doyle, has this very similar diversion off into another space for a long time. People forget it because it's not very often represented. But in this case, what Neil had split up the book into six parts, and he looked at part three and he saw that Crowley and Aziraphale weren't in it very much. So what? And we knew that whatever was going to happen, we needed Butch and Sundance or Thelma and Louise, depending on your point of view, to be there. And Neil also felt, as he sort of viewed it from 30 years distance, that perhaps what he needed to do was open up that relationship a bit more. So we've got half an hour of what I call our treasure, our two treasures, basically exploring the relationship. And it's funny, it's the part that people keep on remarking that they love the most, because you just get to spend time with these two guys and you see them at these different stages in history. And this goes back to your previous question about how do you keep the audience, held. I think one of the things I was trying to do was, I said very early on to production and to Amazon that the tone is that there is no tone, that is our advantage rather than, and we need to teach the audience a vocabulary in Good Omens where they get used to being surprised, get used to suddenly turning up at the crucifixion, turning up at the Noah's Ark or in the Soho in London in the 60s. So I think that's what we did from the beginning of the show. So it opens in the Garden of Eden, but after the credits, we're back with Crowley, and he's in a graveyard, 11 years ago. So the audience are told, if the audience are given vocabulary that includes the word surprise in it all the time, then we hope they would go with it, and it turns out they have done, which is great. I mean, they have done in crazy numbers.
Now, of course, no matter your tools, your crew, your money, your logistics, you're only, as a director, you're only going to be as good as your cast. What's the experience been like for you to get to direct Michael Sheen, who's Aziraphale, and David Tennant, who's Crowley, and all these other great actors? John Hamm is in it. Frances McDormand, as you said, is the voice of God. What's that experience been like? How does that make your job easier?
It makes my job easier because these guys all turned up with their A game and they all wanted to be there. I've done plenty of shows in the past where actors are turning up and they're kind of feeling a bit grumpy because they've not got the part they wanted or whatever, or they wish they were doing something better. What we did with Good Omens was basically, normally on these shows, what you do is you say to your casting director, can you get me somebody like Michael Sheen, somebody like David Tennant, somebody like Frances McDormand or Benedict Cumberbatch? But in our case, we got them all because they turned up and loved the project and thought it was so idiosyncratic. We've got Nick Offerman coming in for just a few scenes. And Nick came to South Africa to shoot for 2 days and flew back again. And he was asked if it was a bit of a long journey. And he said, I would have traveled twice as far for half the lines, which is a great line. And I think the experience for me is my first assistant director at one point said, we don't have a cast list, we've got a leaderboard here, because the top 20 of our call sheet on some days, they'd all led series of films on their own, and here they were turning up to do a few lines here and there. I wouldn't call them background, but not far off it sometimes. They would have to stand and wait for the cameras to come round to them, and they all did it. And they were all magnificent and came, like I say, with their A game. I think they all felt that they didn't want to be the one to drop the ball. So they just, and they saw what David and Michael were doing in the foreground, and just, on we went. And John Hamm was the same, and Jack Whitehall and Adria Hoba and so on. So it's been a wonderful experience. It's a bit like getting an orchestra where all the violins are Stradivariuses. There's not just one, it's all of them.
And then, of course, in terms of the look of the show, it's shot by cinematographer Gavin Finney. What format was used, and why was that chosen? What was that process like? Was film discussed? The fact that you go into biblical events, but you're stylized. How'd you figure all that out?
Well, I've worked with Gavin before, and I mean, we used Alexa SXTs and Alexa Minis, and we also decided to shoot very early on in a 2:3:5 ratio, and because we're broadcasting at 4K HDR, and we used Leica lenses because we wanted the sharpness and the consistency to that feel, and also we needed cameras that could survive in the depths of winter in the UK and in the depths of summer in a sandstorm in South Africa, which where we also shot. So we kind of the Alexa, because we had so much CGI, we had nearly 1,200 CGI shots, about half of which were substantial. There's another half that I can go into more detail if you're interested, but about half of them were really substantial storytelling shots. The other half were, fixes on eyes and things like that. But one of the great things about the Alexa, it gives very good green screen keys for VFX, and it's got really flexible color rendering, which helped us in the grade. And the grades was another crucial point. We had our Neil called him a warlock. Gareth Spensley, our colorist at Molinair, was just a wizard at pulling everything together and adding some. It's very interesting in terms of the technology. I think the way that Gavin and I and Gareth worked is really advanced from even a few years ago, where a colorist was simply be a grader. I mean, Gareth replaced 80% of the skies in Good Omens because it's set in the summer that never finishes, but we were filming in the winter that seemed to never finish in the UK. So all the grey skies were dumped by him and put in skies to suit the storytelling and where we were. And that's part of the richness of the look. So, we the Alexa's sort of latitude could cope with the white sands of Cape Town. And we also had very low key scenes that we had to do in when we were filming Hell. And actually, it was an incredibly reliable system, and nothing broke down over the whole of the 120-day shoot of any importance to us.
And so you shot in South Africa, and were you in the UK? Was it a combination of locations and stages? Where was sort of the headquarters for this endeavor?
We shot about 75% in the UK in Oxfordshire, and we had studios when we needed them. And it was a very similar thing in South Africa, except we were going there for places like, the Garden of Eden set and the Garden of Eden locations, which is a combination of things. And what I'd say is that one of the advantages of having one director is that the schedule can fit that one director instead of having to return to location two or three times. It meant we could go in and go for 2 days to a place, say, and just get it all for the whole series. And it's the same all over the place. We did that many times. And that was a great event. And also because of our very, our crazy cast, I mean, not only did we have all these wonderful A-listers, we also had, about 200 other speaking parts. But it meant that fitting in the schedules of the A-listers was something that I could do because I was the only director, if that makes sense. So when John Hamm is available, that's when we're doing John Hamm. If Michael McKean is available at that time, that's when we're doing Michael. So it's not as simple as that, but it's not far off it. So we had more space to juggle because you only had one director, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and then you mentioned the visual effects. How many on average per episode? And maybe you could sort of describe for those listening, sort of the philosophy behind the CG. This is not Marvel superheroes CG. It seems
No.
simpler, whimsical, stylized, colorful. We have matte paintings, or what look like matte paintings. We have Atlantis revealed, and we're not necessarily trying to convince anyone you actually found an ancient archaeological site to shoot it in. So what was the approach there?
Well, the storytelling part of the another sort of very important part of the, if you like, the DNA of Good Omens is Powell and Pressburger, who were English filmmakers in the 40s, 50s, and 60s who had an extraordinary vision of existence. And they, if you follow the family tree up through Monty Python, you'll find Terry Gilliam's work fits in with that, and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams, and way back to P.G. Wodehouse, this kind of fantasy world that isn't quite real. And what I'd contend is that the CGI might look simple, but it's deliberately made to look simple. It's not. We could have made it look flash if we wanted to. We had the money to do that, but we actually wanted this style that is heightened. You know, it's a world where angels walk on the earth, so you don't want to clamp it down and make it gritty and real. You know, you want it to make it feel like the story is real, but and the world is real, but it doesn't have to be a real England or a real Tadfield or a real anywhere. It's got to feel real for the audience in the storytelling. I mean, the CGI, I guess, had three broad sort of groups. The first one is the kind of simplest ones. There's, I call it the fixing group. So you're fixing twisted contact lenses on Crowley and David Tennant, or you're getting rid of cables, lights that dropped in the background, or a car that goes past in a period thing. Do you know what I mean? It's that sort of stuff. And then the second group is kind of hidden CGI, which the audience shouldn't be ever aware of, particularly if they're holding onto the story. So our main Soho street, where Aziraphale's bookshop is, has got is partly a set build, but in the distance, if anybody watches the series after this podcast, there's a junction about halfway up the road, and everything from then on, and everything from one story up, is all CGI. So that means that we could give a kind of a grandeur to that world, but use CGI to build it. Because there is an event that happens in the bookshop, which I won't spoil for people, that we needed the bookshop to have a facility, let's put it that way, for late in the series to do something extraordinary. And then the third group is the CGI that's very present in the series. And again, I took two broad attitudes to it. For the angel and demon, they do miracles continuously through the show. And the kind of vocabulary that I wanted to use for them was that miracles are nothing to them. They don't do spectacle unless it's a byproduct of things. So they don't throw their hands up in the air like Harry Potter and do magic. They just click their fingers and a miracle happens. They just have to think it and it happens. It's not a big deal to them. It's commonplace. But then as the young Antichrist Adam, as the show evolves, he starts to discover that he can affect the world in different ways, and the CGI for Adam, the things that he does. So, for instance, he imagines that a flying saucer comes down to Earth and speaks to one of our characters. So the flying saucer is actually based on an 11, 12-year-old's imagination, and the flying saucer is actually built from a design of my daughter. When she was 12, she'd made a flying saucer out of cardboard for Christmas, and she gave it to me as a Christmas present, and we used that as the design for the flying saucer. And then the other things that he imagines, like the Kraken and Atlantis, again, it's a 11, 12-year-old boy's version of that, an imagined thing, rather than it being something, whatever a real version of a flying saucer Atlantis is, I don't know, but it's from his perspective, and that's an important difference.
And going back to post-production for a second, as I understood it, you have two editors, and then you have all this visual effects coming in and out. From your perspective as the director, you know, how was the shooting workflow handled? How much was a green screen involved? You know, where you had to kind of do a lot of improvising, and how did you get it all put together, you know, while you're working on, I'm presuming, multiple episodes at any given time.
Multiple episodes every single day, yeah, pretty much. The answer was the two edit suites got on with it while we shot, and then Neil and I got into the cutting rooms after we'd finished and started working our way through it. I was watching assemblies every weekend, and Neil decided not to after we discussed what would be the best way to use his brain in terms of the edit. And I sort of said to him, well, if you can stand it, let's wait till we get you into the edit proper before you see anything cut together. I mean, he was watching dailies, as all the execs were, but he didn't. Nobody watched assemblies apart from me. And the idea behind that is that Neil became the first proper audience for the show cut together, which meant we got a fresh perspective on it. each time. And that was a sort of thing that we repeated quite a lot, where I would go in and do what I would call my version of it, and then Neil would come in and we'd take notes and develop it and evolve it. It was never a conflicting thing. It was always a collaborative sort of feeling. And it was the same working with Amazon. They were incredibly enabling rather than judgmental about what they just wanted the vision of Good Omens to come out. And again, if we've got something that looks different from other shows, it's because of that sort of drive to enable the vision of Good Omens rather than somebody else imposing what they thought the story might be on the show. But in terms of process, we traveled through it episode by episode. Because we felt we were doing a 6-hour movie, it was the only way that we could figure out how to work it. We sometimes jump between episodes to get editors on the move, as it were, because our first editor did the first three and the second one did the last three. So we sort of jumped between episodes to get another cut moving or get some ideas going. And then when we moved into the CGI and ADR stage, it was basically Neil and I doing crazy shifts. I used to call them double days, where we'd start in an edit suite at 8 o'clock in the morning, viewing a cut, make notes, comments, do a bit of work on it. Then we'd go on to do some CGI watching, and then we'd go on to do ADR that might last through the night until 2 o'clock in the morning, because our amazing cast, not unsurprisingly, were spread around all over the world. So we had to fit in with their schedule to get the ADR done. So if anything, the post-production was harder than the shoot for me, and I know it was for Neil, because it was just the sheer volume of the work. You know, if you've got 200 speaking parts, even if somebody has to come in and just do one word of ADR, they still have to be scheduled. They come in and they have a chat, and they do you know what I mean? It's just a mammoth sort of thing for one director and one showrunner to do.
And was given the the volume of the task, did you pretty much piece the show together following Neil's scripts very carefully, or were there pieces of material you shot or acquired that you could move around and put it not where it was originally intended, or was it really pretty much just fitted into what he came out of his brain as you got the ball rolling?
I think it would be fair to say that we follow the scripts pretty religiously, but we also, within the body of scenes, and then, I mean, I'd call it a normal edit, where it's a process of discovery and tuning and finding value, more value in something that you thought perhaps didn't quite work, and then discovering that something you thought was perfect doesn't fit anymore. A perfect shot doesn't fit anymore because the story's not being progressed. And if there's one thing, it's a little bit precocious of me, I think, to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway, that if there's one thing that Neil and I have in common, it's a need to drive a story forwards moment by moment. I mean, he's one of the great storytellers in the world. But I know how to direct telly. So we somehow combined to shift the story forward as an obsession. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you end up editing really quickly. It means that you're finding the story within each shot and within each frame, within each bit of dialogue. And we really started nailing it down to tiny, tiny nuances of performance and everything else, just like you do in most shows. But what we had here was, if you remember, I called the cast a sort of a line of Stradivariuses. The painful thing was that whatever shot you cut to, somebody was doing something amazing. So you were, and sometimes in an edit, you're trying to find the good stuff in amongst the dross. But in this case, we were blessed with these amazing performances from everybody. And honestly, on some of the scenes, you could just have sat on the shot could have sat on Michael McKean's face, or Miranda Richardson, or Michael Sheen, or David Tennant, and the audience would have gone away really happily. But then you can't do that. So the story takes over and the moment take over. So that was kind of how we worked.
And of course, I think we have to ask why the homage to the great rock and roll group Queen is sort of the unofficial soundtrack. Where did that come from? Given that you got this biblical, fantastical nature of the story and a pop culture sort of reference, kind of at certain points guiding you along with it, I guess.
Well, it's a joke in the book that Crowley has a 19 the late 1920s Bentley, a vintage Bentley, and there's a joke in the book that whatever cassette in the book you put into the machine in the car, whether it be Mozart or whether it be the Rolling Stones, it always eventually turns into Queen's greatest hits. So So I now love that joke, and we started to put Queen into the edit before we had the rights to the song, and there's a key bit very early on in episode one where Freddie Mercury actually speaks from beyond the grave to Crowley to give him his instructions as Bohemian Rhapsody is playing on the player in the car. So I really wanted to get that, and but last summer when we were finishing it off, Queen were kind of being reticent about giving us the rights to, they said we could have some of the songs, but we couldn't have Bohemian Rhapsody because the film Bohemian Rhapsody was going to come out. So as we progressed through last summer, it's well known that the director was left Bohemian Rhapsody and a new director arrived, and I think it's fair to say that Queen lost a bit of confidence in the film at that point and said, "Oh, you can have the rights after all; it'll be okay," And then happily, whoever in Queen's management was feeling that was proved completely wrong because Bohemian Rhapsody, the film, became such a the biggest musical in the history of film. So everybody wins. So it's a happy ending to that story, and we get a great Queen soundtrack. But I can't not mention David Arnold's amazing soundtrack, who does the full score for the whole thing. He does 6 hours worth of music, and it's just the most fantastic, earwormy music you could imagine. And I was delighted to have David, who I'd worked with before on a Sherlock episode, and we got on very well, and he's just magnificent in it.
And the other thing that I'm curious about, in putting together this show, you're working for both Amazon and the BBC. I'm curious about the experience of producing what is nominally being called, for lack of a better term, television, for a streaming release platform, a giant new media or form of delivery of media like Amazon. But I'm just curious, is the experience, the feel, the logistics, the detail, the money, the approach, is it just the way it would be if you were doing this for network television, either in the US or the UK, or are there some sort of key differences in the approach? And if so, what were they?
I'd say the key difference is the most obvious one, which is the scale of the ambition of the scripts and therefore the budget that we had. I mean, we've made a 6-hour movie that isn't on the budget levels of Guardians of the Galaxy, but it's at the top end of television. It's in the Game of Thrones sort of area. Do you know what I mean? So I think that was the challenge that BBC Studios, who, I wouldn't want to get into too much detail of what that means, but basically BBC Studios was set up as kind of an independent production arm of the BBC. So it's kind of not working for the BBC, but it is. It's a very, if you had to make it up in Good Omens as being to do with bureaucracy, you would make it up in this way. That's weird. But essentially, it would be no great surprise to hear that Amazon put in the bulk of the money. So the rule in any production is the money gets to say what happens, and it was no different in this case. And the Amazon execs were nothing but the best that I've ever worked with or for. They all they wanted was to get Good Omens out in the best way possible, and they were just helpful at every corner. Their notes in post-production were positive but not demanding. There were suggestions, not demands. Like I say, they were to do with helping to eke out the story and questioning us as a friendly sort of face. And Neil and I just worked with them all the way through. So it's been a fantastic experience in that respect.
Well, and I am, I do wonder about that because you mentioned there's certain ways you can't tell this story. You can't tell it in 2 hours or an hour and a half, even if you had great production values for a feature film and that sort of thing. And people talk about the implications of the new media and all that. But is it fair to say that without this new media existing and an entity like Amazon existing, at a minimum, it would have been a heck of a lot harder to properly tell this story and get it out there to viewers. Is that one of the reasons we hadn't been able to do that
Yes.
until now?
Yes. You've said it precisely the way it is. I just don't see. I mean, we still struggled with even with the very good budget that we had. We still struggled to get the story through, and I had to use every trick in my directing book to make things work. And but the thing, I think, it's a little bit like this. I'm sure Neil wouldn't mind me saying this, that science fantasy, let's not even talk about Neil Gaiman or Terry Pratchett, has been has been a kind of a big niche for a long time, and but the niche is suddenly not the niche anymore, it's the mainstream. And I think that's partly to do with a dual evolution of Netflix and Amazon and companies like that, because if you like, a terrestrial broadcaster, even on an American scale, would struggle to put a budget together that would match the advertising spend that they might get back. Do you know what I mean? To make the figures work. But if you take the whole of the world's science fantasy fans and people that might want to watch this, then that suddenly becomes a doable thing. I mean, Good Omens opened in 220 territories in one drop on Friday the 31st of May. And there's a reason for that, is because we could do our whole advertising thing on a huge scale, but to the world, not just to one territory, not just to the UK or the States or Germany. Do you know what I mean? Which is traditionally what you'd have to do. You'd have to, if you had a big show, you would have to travel around the world with it and introduce it to each territory one at a time. Whereas that doesn't happen anymore. This thing just goes out in one big, big thing. So I think what's happening is that these sort of stories are becoming plausible for companies to make, and they want to make them because they splash out into the world. And and when I say Good Omens is science fantasy, I think it's a much bigger appeal than that as well, I hope. And certainly the figures are showing that we've got a huge audience that the amount of people that have been just directly in touch, you say it's not my cup of tea normally, but which is exactly what we wanted to do. And again, I think part of that is Neil's writing, and a huge part of that is the chemistry between Michael Sheen and David Tennant.
Oh, no question. I think people should see it just for the Bentley alone. I mean, that is a
Yeah.
beautiful vehicle, to say the least.
Well, it's worth. I know we're just about finishing, but it's worth saying about the Bentley, because I know your podcast is more down the technical end of things. How we did the Bentley, because we had to use a variety of techniques, because as you know, having watched it, the show, the Bentley has to travel at 90 miles an hour through the streets of London, and we had a real Bentley, but it was only capable of getting to 90 miles an hour after about an hour of driving down a hill probably. So we had the real one, we had a full CGI asset of the Bentley, and then we also built a full a hard version of the interior of the Bentley that we could use in studio for back projection work, and then the Bentley also has to go on fire, and then we had another Bentley that we blow up at one point as well. So we had a variety of different techniques to do that, but they all combine, I think, really beautifully to make the Bentley feel like it's really Crowley's character expanded.
So as we wind up here, although it sounds like this was an incredible amount of work and not a lot of free time for a certain period of your life, that this was a fun project for you, or that you enjoyed this experience, you learned from this experience. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, no, I love doing Good Omens. It's been the highlight of my career. I mean, people have been very generous and kind, saying, we'll get awards and award nominations for this. But honestly, my reward is just having the show on the shelf and on the Amazon Prime sort of website. And do you know what I mean? Because it was such a joy to make and such a joy to be part of, and the cast were all lovely to work with, and the collaboration with Neil was just a joy.
Well, it certainly works. Very enjoyable. I hope people check it out if they haven't already. And Doug, I wanted to thank you for making some time to talk with us today about Good Omens.
Pleasure. I hope it was interesting. Cheers.
And that was another Studio Daily podcast from the front lines. My conversation with executive producer director Douglas McKinnon about his adventure shooting the Amazon miniseries Good Omens. We hope you enjoyed it. Watch your inbox every month for more newsletters directing you to our monthly podcasts covering the art, science, and people involved in the world of feature filmmaking. I'm Michael Goldman. Have a great day.